Welcome to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. On today's show, we'll meet a Minnesota sailor who participated in the D-Day invasion of World War II, and we'll learn about the VA claims process. But first, it's time for Generally Speaking, a weekly message from the Adjutant General of the Minnesota National Guard, Major General Rick Nash.
The Minnesota National Guard has long trained for emergency contingencies when civilian authorities call for help. We have trained for severe flooding, out-of-control fires, and search and rescue missions. But there is a new threat our soldiers and airmen are training for now. One of my top priorities is to increase the National Guard's capacity to combat cyber warfare. Cyber warfare is internet-based conflict involving politically motivated attacks on information and information systems. Cyber warfare attacks can disable official websites and networks, disrupt or disable essential services, steal or alter classified data, and cripple financial systems. The Minnesota National Guard has full-time staff whose job it is to track cyber issues and keep us ahead of a cyber attack. We have also identified soldiers and airmen within the force who are capable of being called up to fight a cyber attack or cyber-triggered traditional emergency. Such an emergency would require a coordinated response among several agencies and levels of government. We are working with other state, local, and federal agencies to develop these relationships and to develop and train with plans of execution for varying scenarios. I am pleased to tell you that the Department of Military Affairs conducts cyber response rehearsals annually and is consistently preparing to address a cyber warfare threat in Minnesota head-on.
Thank you, General Nash. For more information, please go to MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com. During World War II, the Battle of Normandy lasted from June 1944 to August 1944, resulting in the Allied liberation of Western Europe from Nazi Germany's control. Codenamed Operation Overlord, the battle began on June 6, 1944, also known as D-Day, when some 156,000 American, British, and Canadian forces landed on five beaches along a 50-mile stretch of the heavily fortified coast of France's Normandy region. The invasion was one of the largest amphibious military assaults in history and required extensive planning. By late August 1944, all of northern France had been liberated, and by the following spring, the Allies had defeated the Germans. The Normandy landings had been called the beginning of the end of the war in Europe. And joining us today to talk about D-Day and his service in the United States Navy during World War II is Ken MacArthur. Ken, welcome to Minnesota Military Radio.
Thank you.
Ken, it's been a few years ago since you enlisted in the Navy. Can you tell us, did you go to college before you enlisted in the Navy?
Yes, I did. And it took quite some time to get into the Navy. I didn't just want it one day and get it the next. I traveled to Minneapolis where there was the Office of Naval Personnel. And I was in Superior, Wisconsin, so it was an overnight ride on a slow train. I got there, and I was refused. But they said, you can come back. And so the next day, I was back. I had gone home and had something to eat, and I got some clean clothes and went back down to Minneapolis and tried it again, and I missed again. They failed me again. And that went on until Thursday of the week, the first refusal was on Monday, and I didn't get approved until Thursday. And I was in Minneapolis by train and back in Superior by train each one of those days. So it was fairly obvious that I wanted to get in the Navy.
And why did you choose the Navy, Ken?
Well, there are two ways to answer that. I'll give you the honest one. The food in the Army, I'm sure, is good if you like that kind of food, where you get pellets to swallow, and that's supposed to satisfy you. Whereas in the Navy, you get mashed potatoes and gravy and meat and the whole business. Now, that was one factor. The other, my bed was always with me when I was in the Navy. It never would have been with me in the Army. So it was an easy call for me, and that didn't necessarily make it non-appreciative of the advantages in the Army. I just couldn't think of them.
But you wanted some good chow, and you didn't want to sleep on the ground.
That's exactly it.
It turned out pretty well, didn't it?
It sure did. I should say it did.
So you went in, did you go in as an ensign?
I did. Well, I went in with a first-class sailor with the 13-button trousers, you know. And that's the way I started at Notre Dame. And 4 months later, then I got to wear a regular uniform, and I was an ensign.
So your basic training was at Notre Dame?
Yes. And then from there out to the University of California at Berkeley for training in diesel engineering. Type of aircraft I was on, everything is diesel. So you had to know how to do something to it.
So you went to California for some training. What kind of training was that?
Diesel engineering. That and there was a 4 month course in diesel engineering, and we did nothing but concentrate on diesels. But in the type of craft we were going to be assigned to, everything was diesel, and it proved out. From there, we went to the East Coast, and we awaited the completion of the first of the trip we were going to have of the ship we were going to have, We had about 1 month wait in New York, and then our ship was produced.
And what was the name of that ship?
It was the LCIL 520.
And then you sailed that over to England?
Yes. Uh-huh. Went from when we picked up the ship, we took it down to Norfolk, and we weren't there very long before we were assigned to a group that was going to England. So that's when we first got to England, and we stayed there until the invasion.
And so how long were you in England? Quite a few months?
Oh, yes, for several months. And we kept our shells presumably sharp by maneuvers in the channel. And it was an interesting experience to me, too, because as we sailed into this small port, I could see a group of buildings up on the hill, and one was of kind of reddish brick, and I thought, I bet that's a church. I learned later it was. And on just next to the pulpit was a door with no door, just a piece of cloth hanging there. My first trip to church there, I sat where I could see that door, and I noticed that when we sang, the curtain swayed. And finally it swayed large enough so I could see there was a young man there with a tall, tall stick, and he was pumping for all he was worth so that organ had the air it needed to run. There were surprise things in England, surprise for me anyway, that kept occurring, and that was one that I'd never forget.
We're speaking with Ken MacArthur about his time in World War II and over in England on Minnesota Military Radio. I was asking you how many troops you saw in England and how many ships, and you said you were down on the southern end and didn't really see most of the Armada.
No, that's right. We didn't. And we didn't move up north on the channel until just before the invasion. When we were assigned to move up the channel, we knew that something was coming soon, and the only thing would be the invasion, of course. So we moved up the channel and docked. And when I came up from dinner that night, a ship had turned up next to us, and I looked on that ship and saw a young man I'd met. He lived in East End of Superior. Can you imagine a little town like Superior, Wisconsin, and a little suburb of it? And way over there, here's a man I knew back home. It was a surprise. Little things like that appraised me. I just couldn't imagine it.
It is a small world after all, isn't it?
I should say it is. I should say so.
Ken, we have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about D-Day and the Armada and all of the excitement involved around that. Okay. We're speaking with Ken MacArthur on Minnesota Military Radio. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. We've been talking to Ken MacArthur about his time as a sailor in World War II and his build-up to D-Day, which was June 6, 1944, when 156,000 troops, primarily from the United States, the United Kingdom, and Canada, went to invade the beaches of the Normandy area, and they landed on five beaches, Utah, Omaha, Gold, Juneau, and Sword. And the Armada involves 6,900 ships and landing craft, 50,000 vehicles, 11,500 planes, and it was called Operation Overload. And the casualties the first day D-Day dead were 4,413, including 2,499 Americans and 1,914 other Allied nations. And so it was the largest invasion in the history of the world, as far as we know. And Ken, when we went to break, you were telling us that you knew when your ship was ordered to go up north in the channel that something was up, and scuttlebutt probably was that is this really it? Is this the invasion?
That's correct. And of course, that proved true. And we didn't stay there tied up very long before, as I looked out, I saw this like an ant trail. But everything was going in one direction. That was towards France. No returns.
The huge armada.
Yeah. And the order was, if you break down, get a tow, but don't turn around.
You're going to France whether you like it or not.
Right, that's right. And knowing what was coming, there were some who didn't like it. I don't think any of us danced with joy. But we knew that it has been waiting for it for a long time, and here it was.
Now, you were an officer aboard LCIL 520, which was a troop transport ship. It carried, was it 500 soldiers?
We had 500 soldiers aboard who were with us, who joined us just before we left England. And then they were with us all hand. The crew did a very generous thing, I think. They decided that they would share their food with the Army, and they would eat Army food every other meal.
So you
that
tried
was
to
their idea. Nobody else. Nobody gave it to them.
Share the pain a little bit.
That's right.
Now, how was the mood aboard ship when you started? When you finally got off to sail and heading towards France? Was it quiet? How were the soldiers? How were your sailors?
There was no hurrahs. It wasn't a day to celebrate for anyone. But it was a day of finishing, I think, that we all felt. It might not come that day. Might not come the next day, but it would come before we left France.
So it was pretty sober, pretty serious.
I should say so.
Well, when you got close to France, what happened? Was there bombardments going on?
I should say so, yes. We dropped anchor in Mulberry Harbor, which was a harbor made up by the Army. And we just waited there while the things that preceded us would have to be accomplished. And as we sat there at harbor, I could hear the large shells from the big ships out behind us whisper as they passed overhead. And when that was ended, the Army Air Corps came in and dropped many, 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 many bombs. I couldn't understand how anything could live and survive that bombardment. Then there were other ships that came in with their particular weapon. And when they finished, then we moved in and started putting the soldiers ashore.
So they really pounded the beaches.
They did. And I've never been more long in all my life. I was so sure that everything on that beach had been killed. I was very, very long.
But the German pillboxes and bunkers were pretty effective, weren't
they? Yes, I should say so. They had two bunkers and with built of cement, and they had openings about the shape of a brick, and it was perfect for shooting out of and off, damn hard to hit when you shot at it. So they had a good position as far as we were concerned. It was a good position for them, not for us.
Now, the beach that you were assigned to was Omaha Beach?
Yes.
Which was, as I understand it, the toughest one, the toughest battle.
Yes, it was.
Can you explain to me how your ship worked? Your ship actually went up to the beach?
Yes, the LCILs were made to put the nose into the sand of the beach. Hopefully it was sand. If it was gravel, you put your nose in there. Hopefully you would get the nose in far enough so that the soldiers coming off the ramps could land and dry sand. That was not the case with Omaha. We got in as close as we could, but the soldiers that got off safely had water up to their waist, and that wasn't bad.
So you nosed in and lowered some ramps so they could get off?
Yes, there were two ramps on an LCIL, one on each side of the bow, attached by a steel rope, and that was attached to a diesel engine in the forecastle. and at command, that diesel would pull the rope in or pull it out, and as to start with, it pulled the ramps forward until they had reached the end of the ramp. Then they released it, and it dropped. That one end dropped, and it was ready for use to get onto the beach.
We're speaking with Ken MacArthur about his experience on D-Day, June 6, 1944, in World War II, when his ship, LCIL 520, disembarked 500 soldiers on the beach at Omaha. Now, Ken, when those ramps were down and the soldiers were getting off, were they totally exposed to that German fire?
They were completely exposed. There was nothing to protect them as they went down the ramp. As a matter of fact, the ramp was somewhat of a handicap then because it slowed them. Only one person at a time was able to go down the ramp. And that presented beautiful targets for the soldiers, for the German show soldiers who were firing at them out of these cement emplacements.
The beach must have been a terrible place and a bad sight to see.
Oh, it was horrible! It was horrible. I felt for the army boys that were going down. I felt for them, and there wasn't a blasted thing I could do or anybody else could. They were going to hit that beach, and they did.
So how long did it take you to unload all 500 soldiers?
It was about an hour.
And you were taking fire that whole time?
Yes.
Once you got them disembarked from the ship, then what did your ship do? What did you do after that?
We withdrew from the ship, and fortunately we hadn't hit it so hard that we couldn't withdraw. We withdrew and went out and tied up to the old British battleship, the Centurion, that was part of Mulberry Harbor. And the idea of our tying up there was that we had been assigned the job of being a hotel, so to speak, for the officer and his men that would be preparing the beach, cleaning it up, preparing it to receive the supplies and materials that would be needed for an army that was proceeding inland.
So you actually had to sink a couple of ships, and you had to create a harbor so you could unload the ships coming with all the material and supplies and ammo and vehicles. And so number one was, let's get on the beach and start getting inland. And number two, now let's start to figure out how we can get the supplies to the soldiers on the ground.
That's right.
So how long were you in Mulberry Harbor then?
It was a week to 10 days. I don't know exactly how long it was. We were there long enough to experience that horrible storm that hit the English Channel just a week after D-Day. And that took more... gave more damage to the American Navy than anything else that happened that day.
Now, those 10 days that you were there, did you ever get off the ship and go ashore? Or?
I did, and I wouldn't care to describe what I saw, because it was just the second day, the next day after we had had our ship in. And what I saw was something I wouldn't care to even describe.
Well, it was as they say, the biggest invasion on record, and we lost an awful lot of people, and so did the Allies. And fortunately, we got off the beaches and made a landing, and were successful over a period of time, but at a huge cost, wasn't it?
I should say so. It had to be considered a success, but there were spots where it was a failure. In the construction, in the destruction, that it was so far. General.
Ken, I'd like to thank you for coming in today. For our listeners, if you want to go to MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com, we'll have a bonus segment about what Ken did after D-Day that you can listen to online on the podcast. And for the rest of you on the network, we'll be back in a few moments to tell you about the VA claims process. We're speaking with Ken MacArthur, a sailor who experienced D-Day in World War II. Please stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Minnesota Military Radio Network. Stay tuned for more and follow us at MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com.
Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons, and we're doing a bonus segment with Ken MacArthur, a local sailor who experienced D-Day and World War II and the nastiness of the landing at Omaha Beach in Normandy aboard the LCIL 520. Now, Ken, your career in the Navy, you ended up being a lieutenant?
That's right.
In 03?
Yes.
And were you on the same ship throughout your service?
No. When we got back to the United States, the crew, practically all of the crew and all of the officers were put on leave, and they would never come back. They would go to the Pacific.
Be reassigned then.
I stayed with the ship because it was going to be remodeled into something else other than a straight LCI. And then I got another ship that was a remodeled LCI. And that was being used to cart dignitaries, national dignitaries, around Chesapeake Bay and up the river to the military bases up there. And that was I'm trying to think of the name, but...
Some pretty soft duty compared to D-Day, isn't it?
I should say so. I should say it was.
Well, let's go back to Normandy Beach now. You unloaded the sailors on that first day, and then you tied up to the Mulberry for about 10 days to just to help be a support ship. What happened to your ship after that? Where were you sent next?
We went to England first for some light repair, and then we went down to Italy for a more major repair.
So your ship was beat up quite a bit at Normandy?
Oh, yes. Yes, we took a beating, but we could still float, which was important to us.
That was kind of important, yes. You didn't want that nice cushy bed to be waterlogged, did you?
I should say not.
So you got refitted down in Italy?
In Italy, yes, we did. And then we went to southern France, and we just waited there for our group either to catch us up or we would catch them. And it was there that we got the message to go to Northern Africa and at Mirz El Kabir. And then we were going to join a convoy going back to the States.
Well, by that time, the fighting in North Africa should have been over with.
Oh, yes, it was. And we had a sad message as we approached the Mirz El Kabir. The light flashing light said that immediately at our arrival, put all animals ashore, and that hit us rather hard. But you know about that.
Well, I think we should talk about that. You had a mascot on the ship named Mike.
Yes, we had a wonderful, wonderful monkey named Mike. He came on board when he was extremely young. And he was on our ship and off our ship at various times, depending on what our assignment was and whether he could stay with us. We were fortunate enough to be able to keep him. And then Mike stayed with us all the way until we got to Africa, and then he met his demise there.
I understand he was a little bit of an alarm clock on the ship.
Oh, he was. When, you know, it's customary for the crew to want to stay in bed as long as they can in the morning. And that all ended with Mike. Mike just delighted in running down the stairs, I should say the ladder, to be correct for Navy. And he would bounce from bunk to bunk to bunk, and he'd grab the nose and twist it, and then you muss their hair up royally. And oddly enough, the crew liked that. They loved Mike so much that he could do anything to them, and he got them up. And so that was to the good of the whole ship.
Sounds like Mike provided the comic relief.
He did. I should say so. We had the sailor who ran the crew on the deck was a young man from Boston, tall young man, good looking, very well liked, did a very efficient job. And the crew quite often would form a circle on the deck. They made sure that the person holding the monkey was on one side of the circle, and directly across was this tall guy from Boston. And somebody, when Mike wasn't looking, would slap their hands together, and his tail happened to be between the two hands. And then everybody pointed at this guy across the circle. Mike loved everybody in the crew except that one man. And that one man couldn't even get close to him.
So did Mike go after him then?
He didn't attack him, no.
No.
But he also made it clear that he didn't want anything to do with him.
Poor guy. That was too bad.
Yes. Mike had another failure. He'd get into the flag bag and drop the flags to the bottom of the bag, and of course it was impossible to haul them out close enough when there was a flag course that we had to repeat.
So these were your signal flags?
Our signal flags, yes. And oddly enough, nobody ever saw him do it, but everybody knew it was Mike, and he would always get those flags and drop them into the bottom of the bag. I think he knew he was being a little devil when he did it, but he continued to do it, and the crew continued to accept it, even the signalmen. But fortunately, the other ships in our group knew what was going on, so they didn't expect us to get a hoist up very fast.
So you were the slowest ship in the group to get your signal flags
up. We were.
Thanks to Mike the Monkey. So after D-Day, then you were sent around to Italy and down to Africa. Were you just hauling troops and hauling supplies and minor missions like that?
Yes, that would essentially be it. And they're very minor and very few. We had a lot of off time then, standing aboard the ship in southern France. It was a wonderful place to swim because you could see 30 feet of water down and this nice white sand at the bottom and no other ships around us disturbing us. So we did a lot of swim time, too. We got a little vacation then after all the mess we'd been in.
Ken, it sounds like you're happy with your decision to join the Navy and have some good grub and a nice place to sleep.
I should say so.
Turned out all right.
I should say so. I'd recommend it to anyone if they had to go in service, that is.
Ken, there's a lot of young folks today that maybe haven't studied World War II very much, and they know that Germany took over Europe and caused a lot of trouble, and they maybe know about the invasion. Looking back on it, it was something that had to be done, wasn't it?
Yes, I should say so. There's no question about that. And nobody could anticipate the intensity of what would happen, what would fall, how big it would be, and how destructive.
And I don't think that people today understand world war, the world at war, and maybe don't understand that when you went to war, when you signed up and went in the Navy, you weren't coming home till it was done.
That's right. That was this we were going to win and not end it halfway.
So you and your crew and all your shipmates, we were determined to get it done, weren't you?
I should say so. We were.
And it was a good cause and a good mission.
You bet it was.
Despite the horror at Omaha Beach on D-Day.
Oh, that was awful. That was awful. It was better to be in the Navy that day than in the Army.
And the soldiers took the brunt of it, didn't they?
I should say they did.
Ken, do you have any thoughts for our listeners about D-Day and World War II and the part that the United States took in liberating Europe?
No, I don't think so. I think it was a necessary step to take, and probably the right men were in the right positions who could and would make the right decisions. Despite a lot of criticism at that time.
And even back here at home in America, it was a complete war effort, wasn't it?
I should say it was.
Aircraft and ships and tanks and ammunition and the entire economy of the United States was working on winning this war.
Certainly it was. And for those who had some misgivings about the destructiveness, there was a picture of Japan two years after the war. And it was taken at the right place. It showed total destruction. We didn't experience anything like that in the United States. Everything was on the ground. And to see that one picture, I think that it would tend to soften the bitterness that all of us felt towards Japan at that time.
Because the bomb was so devastating.
I should say it was.
But it did bring an end to that war, didn't it?
It did. That's right, it did.
So when did you finally get out of the service, Ken?
Well, after my Chesapeake party,
nice cruise on the Chesapeake and that new ship.
One of the nice things that happened to me there was a four striper who came aboard along with some of these visitors who were being entertained. And he happened to share my room. We became pretty good friends just in that short time. He was a nice guy. And so after they had gone back to their various places of business, I had a call from Washington telling me to come up to personnel. And I went up there, and here I had an assignment that was a free-for-all. It would take me to the various bases that existed between Washington and Minneapolis. And I had to stop in each one of those. And when I got to the last one, I was off. I was through.
That was the end of your service.
About getting a nice goodbye, that was it.
They let you work your way all the way home.
That's right.
That was a pretty nice gift at the end, wasn't it?
I should say it was. I met some nice people in the Army, some of them wearing heavy brass, others with no brass at all, but they were nice people.
Ken, you got any final thoughts for our listeners about World War II?
No, I think about it as little as I can.
Well, Ken, I appreciate you coming in and sharing your story of D-Day and your service in the Navy in World War II, and appreciate your coming in.
My pleasure.
Thank you. That was Ken MacArthur, a local sailor who experienced D-Day and World War II on Minnesota Military Radio. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. In a moment, we're going to meet a member of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs and talk about claims for veterans. But first, it's time for the Commissioner's Corner, a weekly update from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Now here's Commissioner Larry Shelletow.
The Minnesota Warriors Ice Hockey Program has been organized for charitable and educational purposes for veterans of the U.S. military who are wounded, injured, or otherwise disabled. This program assists veterans with reintegration into civilian life. The program educates, trains, motivates, and encourages individuals who have physical or mental disabilities incurred during service to the United States to participate in the sports of hockey. The Warriors welcome players of any age and skill level, male or female, at any level of disability. The program uses the game of hockey to assist individuals with disabilities in developing self-confidence, adjusting to their new lifestyle, rehabilitation, and much more. To learn more, visit mnwarriors.com.
Thank you, Commissioner Shelletow. For more information, please go to minnesotamilitaryradio.com. Joining me now is Rolando Sotolongo, who is with the Claims Development and Claims Office Customer Service, part of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Rolando, welcome to Minnesota Military Radio.
Thank you so much, Tom. It's an honor to be here. And first of all, I just want to thank you for your service as well.
Well, it's a pleasure and an honor to be able to tell these stories and inform all the veterans in Minnesota about if they've got some kind of issue, how do I go file a claim? And we're going to talk about that in a moment. But first, you were a Marine. Once a Marine, always a Marine.
That is correct, Tom. Once a Marine, always a Marine. I did 20 years in the United States Marine Corps, retired in 2006, and was very fortunate to fall into a position where I continue to work with veterans and give them back to their families as well.
So which was tougher, being a gunnery sergeant in the United States Marine Corps or being a claims officer for the MDVA?
Oh, wow. Being a gunnery sergeant, it's very honorable. It's something that you strive to be one day to be leader of Marines. And once you get to that position, you're pretty much the boss and whatever you say goes. But in the claims, you know, we deal with a lot of situations with veterans that are not in the best situations for them as far as their claim. So sometimes they come in and they're a little not happy. Let's just put it that way. And, you know, our job is to make sure that they understand what our role is there in the claims office, which is to advocate for them. So I would say they're both equally the same as far as importance for me to give back is and have the passion to serve those veterans because they served our country. So I do love my job today, and I loved my job as a Marine gunnery sergeant.
So, Connie, what's the story? How did you get from the Marines to the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs?
Well, on my last stint, I was with MP Company here in Fort Snelling, down on Bloomington Road. Did my last three and a half years there. I was right at my breaking point. I was getting ready to pick up Master Sergeant. My son, Christopher, which is currently serving our country now, he's the first lieutenant in the Marines, was getting ready to try to get into the United States Naval Academy. So I had a tough decision. He was in the middle of high school, and I didn't want to take that chance to move him out of there. So I decided to hang him up after 20 and focus on, you know, helping my son get his dreams and goals established.
And a position opened at the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, and you went, huh?
Well, it took a year. When I first was getting ready to retire from the Marine Corps, I went down to go seek what type of benefits I had, and that's where I met my boss, Ron Quadi. I believe he was on your show not too long ago as well.
Yes, he was.
We kind of hit it off. After that, I didn't talk to Ron for about a year and a half, and all of a sudden I started working in corrections. I was a correction officer for a year. I get a call from Ron out of the blue about a year later and asking me, you know, what was I doing? And I told him I was a corrections officer in this one facility, and he started laughing, and he's like, well, that's where I used to work before I started working at MNDVA. So he offered me a job. He asked me to interview, and then the rest is history. I've been with the department going on 7 years next month, and been a supervisor for the claims division for 6 in St. Paul.
Now, your offices are out in the federal building by the airport.
That is correct. It's on One Federal Drive.
And what is your job? What do you do with claims? What does that whole thing involve?
Well, it's a very important job for the simple fact that the VA claims process can be very complicated. We have several veterans that try to go through that process by themselves and find it very difficult to maneuver through that red tape. So we're there as advocates. We're there to support them, to help them develop a fully developed claim, so that way when a decision is made by the VA that they make the appropriate decision. So our role there is to support the veteran and their family members when they come into our office to get a well-developed claim, and to help them if they need medical assistance at the VA hospital or whatnot, and give them the resources that they need to be successful in life.
We're speaking with Rolando Sotolongo from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs on Minnesota Military Radio. Now, Gani, we've said on this program, I don't know how many times, that if a veteran has some kind of issue or when they're mustering out, first thing they should do is take their discharge paper, their DD-214, and go register with their county veteran service officer. And a lot of times if they have some kind of claim, that's initiated by the county veteran service officer. But then you come into play and help advocate.
That's correct, Tom. We always advocate for our veterans. Even if they walk into our building, we would definitely work with the veteran, but we always refer back to the county that they're from. Two sets of eyes are always better than one, and we want them to engage because there might be some county benefits that they might be entitled to as well. So we always try to refer them back once we help them. And, you know, we have a great relationship with the counties. And so what happens is when you go into your county, you know, always like you said earlier, you need to register your DD-214 as soon as you come back with your county so they can have that of record, because that's very important. That document is very important for the process. Once you start doing that and start working with your county, if you have any claims that you might want to claim, for any disabilities that you have, at that time, the county veteran service officer will help you start putting your package together for your claim. At that time, the county veteran service officer would ask you if you have any preference of what organization you want to represent you. So at that point, if you choose the Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs or the American Legion, those claims will come to our office.
So then if a service member has some kind of an issue about an injury that was suffered while he's in the military, they start the claim with the county veteran service officer, and they come over with you and say, okay, I'm having a little trouble with this claim. What do I need to do to prove it up? And then you help them with that?
Absolutely. A lot of times the VA would do initial development on your claim. If you're missing, let's say there's no proof of the injury in service, then VA might come back and ask you, well, do you have any evidence or any statements or lay statements from anybody that could verify that this incident happened? So it all depends on how the claim plays out, but there'll be development letters from the VA. And a lot of the times the veterans get a little confused at that point. So I always tell veterans, you know, always use your county veteran service officer. But if you have a question that you're confused about anything in the process, to call our office, your power of attorney, and we'll walk you through that process and let you know exactly what the VA is looking for in order to make that decision on your behalf.
Now, Gunny, what happens if they process a claim and the VA made a decision and they've given them a low rating and they think they've had a catastrophic injury of some kind? What can you do about that?
That's a good question, Tom. A lot of the times there's veterans that are not satisfied with their decision that's made by the VA. If the veteran is not satisfied, there's always an appeal process. And that's part of what we do in that office as well. We work with appeals. We help the veteran through an appeal process all the way up to Washington, D.C., through the Board of Veteran of Appeals. And so what we do is gather all the information and figure out the rationale behind the decision that the VA made and try to counter and see if it was a development issue, if it was a diagnosis that maybe that was lacking. So once we figure out why the decision was made the way it was, then we go forward from there and advocate for the veteran, let them know what they need to do to have a successful claim on the appeal process.
And Gunny, how often do you come across people of my generation, Vietnam vets, that maybe can't find their DD-214 and never wanted to bother filing, but they've got serious problems?
Well, the Vietnam veterans are near and dear to my heart. They're probably one of the most difficult to work with at times because they you have to gain their trust. And so the first thing that I do with them is I introduce myself and I start talking about different things just so they can feel comfortable with me, because it's about trust at that point. And so as far as their DD-214s, if they're missing DD-214, there are several things that we can do to try to retrieve your DD-214. We can check with the counties to see if it was ever registered at the county when they got out, or go through St. Louis and request those records through St. Louis, where the storage of all the records are maintained. So there's a lot of things that you can do to help the veteran and helping them fill out those forms correctly so they can get them back in a timely fashion. But you could always still file your claim, and the VA has the duty to assist to get those records.
Gunny, we have to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk more about the claims process and the help that you provide at the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. We're speaking with Rolando Sotolongo on Minnesota Military Radio. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. We've been talking today about the claims process, aided by the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, and my guest has been Rolando Sotolongo. Gunny, we started talking about Vietnam veterans, and I know a lot of my buddies have always been reluctant to file any claims, and some of them, don't know what they did with their discharge certificates, but they're getting to an age now where they're getting some of these old issues are coming up, and they're having problems, and, how have you been able to help those guys?
Well, in those cases, Tom, those can be very difficult because of the lapse of time from when they were in service and they get out. So you're talking about 30, 40 years later, they're coming in filing claims, and the lack of evidence in the service treatment records to show that they had an injury in service can be very difficult at times. But that doesn't stop us from trying to help the veteran. We're trained to ask questions. I had a certain example. I had a Vietnam veteran that we couldn't prove that he was in country in Vietnam. And talking to the veteran, you can tell that he was in there, but his DD-214 didn't validate that. So we had to ask a lot of questions. And one of the things that I always ask my Vietnam veterans is, How do we prove that you were in Vietnam? It doesn't say you're DD-214. There's some things that are not marrying up, and the VA is saying that you weren't in country. How do we overcome those obstacles? And one of the things that I always tell my veterans, well, I know that every Vietnam veteran keeps a little junk box, memento that they keep in their house somewhere. They had probably opened in 30 years. And Rolando, yes, absolutely. I got one at home. I said, well, when you go home tonight, what I want you to do is open that box up, take all the cobwebs out, dust it all out, and I want you to start going through it. Find any pictures, any letters you might may have wrote when you were in country back home, anything that you have that can possibly show that you were in country at one point in time.
Copies of orders, things
copies
like that.
Copies of anything. I've won cases that way where, you know, there was no hope for the veteran. The veteran was just in the last stages of the appeal process. And, you know, just that simple question that I asked, and just the bell rang. And next thing you know, they're bringing stuff in. They're bringing letters with postmark from where they mailed it out in the country. And all I did was walk it up to the VA and say, here's your evidence, and get it granted. It's an awesome feeling to be able to help someone that's been struggling through this whole process. And this process can take anywhere in the appeal process between 2 to 5 years sometimes, depending on the situation. So it's very gratifying. I'm very passionate. My team is very passionate about helping every single veteran that comes and walks through those doors in our office, at the claims office. So we take our work very serious, and we want to help everyone, not only the veterans, but their family members, the widows, the ones that are stayed back. We emphasize I think our real mission in there is to help every veteran, but it's the appeals process, because we know that's the most difficult time for a veteran to get a letter in the mail by the VA to say they were denied, knowing that they did get injured in service, and to be able to win a case like that in any form, the gratitude that we get back from our veterans is one that you can't even imagine.
Now, Gunny, it seems like every theater of war had its issues. Vietnam, Agent Orange, and exposure to that. Some of the Gulf War was the burning oil fields. Yes. And the lung problems, and the latest ones, a lot of traumatic brain injury and those type of things. So then it becomes important to prove that not only were they deployed, but they were in country and they were in those situations where those issues had developed.
Correct. And part of that is developing the claim. And when I say developing the claim, is if you're lacking evidence somewhere, and you know, you just ask about buddy statements. Was there anyone there with you when this happened? Can you get a statement from your buddy? Can you get a lay statement from your spouse or somebody that knew you or saw that?
Commanding officer.
Yeah, your staff sergeant that gave you the orders to do that, you know, if you fell off a 5-ton and got hurt but never went to medical and documented it. That's where we have the problems and where we need the work, where, you know, we always tell my veterans, you're your best advocate. I'm your advocate, but I'm telling you the things that you need to have a well-developed claim, so we don't have to wait 2 to 3 years on an appeal process. I want to win now. I don't want to win 3 or 5 years from now.
Gunny, we're just about out of time. Any final thoughts for our veterans listening today that might have some issues?
Yes, sir. And again, our office is very passionate to serve veterans. And what I'd ask, you know, every time I see a young service member, I always tell them, make sure you make copies of your medical records before you get out of service. Part of the problems that we're having is that it's not stuff that's not documented, lost, burned in a fire, whatever. There's always things that happen. So always I try to keep copies of your records before you get out of service. That way it just makes our job a lot easier when you come and see us.
And always visit with your county veteran service officer.
Absolutely.
And they can give them a call at the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs and just ask for the claims officers.
Absolutely, sir.
Rolando, thanks for joining us today.
It was a great honor, sir. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak in veterans' behalf.
Happy to have you here. That was Rolando Sotolongo from Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs Claims Office. Joining me now is the senior enlisted advisor to the Adjutant General of the Minnesota National Guard, Command Sergeant Major Doug Wortham. Sergeant Major, welcome back to the show.
Hello, Tom. Once again, it's great to be with you. How are you doing today?
Well, we're busy weeks every week and trying to get a lot of these good stories and information out to people all over the state on our network of 23 stations all across Minnesota.
23 stations. I mean, it's just amazing, you know, when you're starting with just one and look at how far you've grown. I mean, what a great, great deal for all of our military members and, of course, the state of Minnesota.
Well, and if anybody's hearing this or has a hometown that's not part of the network, just have those stations go to MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com and contact me, and we'll make the show available on your favorite local station for free. Sergeant Major, I know that Camp Ripley's really busy in the summer, but I think you just had something up there called Operation Future Warrior.
We sure did, Tom. What a great event. This is an opportunity for our new recruits that are getting ready to go to either basic training or their advanced individual training. They come up to Camp Ripley for one final weekend before they leave for training, and they do what we call Warrior Stakes, part of Operation Future Warrior. And it's a long weekend of different activities, training, things that we do in order to get them prepared just a little bit better to head off to training.
Sergeant Major, it's pretty important to fill in the bottom there. I know we were talking about this on the program all the time about the readiness status of the soldiers and airmen of the Minnesota National Guard. And, of course, that's because you've got a lot of mature soldiers and airmen there that have been deployed many, many times. But you always have to keep filling in at the bottom and keep training people so that they can take their turn 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Tom. You know, we've got great soldiers and airmen in our organization, in our National Guard family. And you know what? Every one of us gets a little bit older, and there comes a point in time where, you know, we have to make that hard decision to exit the force. And of course, you can't leave a void. So we are always, you know, looking for the next recruit, that person to be trained in so that when we leave, we have someone there to step in right behind us and keep this mission moving forward.
So you're always looking for good men and women and a diverse force that comes from all of the diverse types of folks that live in Minnesota.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know what? We want to include everybody. So I like to talk about inclusion versus diversity. When you include more people, when you bring the benefits of what the National Guard has to more people, to our diverse population, when we do that, we, in virtue then, or as a result of that, we get that diverse force that's bringing all these different experiences, whether it's race, ethnic background, gender background, it doesn't matter. We want to give everybody an opportunity to explore what the Minnesota National Guard has to offer and then hopefully find them a spot on our team.
Well, Sergeant Major, you're the top enlisted soldier in the Minnesota National Guard. When you look back at your career, and you were talking to some of our listeners today considering joining the Minnesota Army or Air National Guard, what would you tell them?
Well, I think we've talked about this a few times before, and you know what? It was the right decision for me when I made that call at age 17. And you know what? This organization, the military in general, not just the National Guard, but I mean, our military is a great organization. And, of course, I'm biased because I am the senior enlisted advisor for the Minnesota National Guard, and we have something to offer everybody. And if you want to be a part of something that's bigger than you, this is an organization to do it. This is a great opportunity to give back to your country and be a part of something that continues to fight for the liberties and the freedoms that we as Americans get to enjoy every single day.
Sergeant Major, we started out today talking about Camp Ripley and how busy it is up there this summer, but we also have to be cognizant of the safety factor.
We sure do. You know, Memorial Day, we just celebrated that, and that marks the beginning of what they call the 101 critical days of summer. And regardless of what we're doing on the lake, out in the yard, just, you know, enjoying time with family, safety is always a big concern. And you mentioned Camp Ripley. There's a lot of moving pieces going on up at Camp Ripley this summer. It's going to be very, very busy. And so just a gentle reminder to all of our soldiers and airmen and all of our citizens across this great state, just be cognizant of what you're doing, be aware of your surroundings, be safe, and have fun.
Sergeant Major, thanks for joining us again.
Tom, it is always my pleasure. I look forward to the next opportunity we get together.
Thank you, sir. That was the senior enlisted advisor to the Adjutant General of the Minnesota National Guard, Command Sergeant Major Doug Wortham. We have one announcement today. Please join the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, Mall of America, and New York Times bestselling author of Ashley's War, Gail Zemach Lemon, in honoring military women past and present and learn about their increasing role in combat. Private event and book signing will take place June 7th, 2015. Visit MinnesotaVeteran.org for details and registration. Please remember to visit MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com for bonus coverage of Ken MacArthur and his story of D-Day and Normandy in World War II. Thanks for listening to this edition of Minnesota Military Radio. I'd like to thank our guests for joining us this week, Ken MacArthur, Rolando Sotolongo, Command Sergeant Major Doug Wortham, Commissioner Larry Shelto, the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, and finally, Minnesota's Adjutant General, Major General Rick Nash. Please join us next week as we talk about some great events happening all across Minnesota this summer. That's coming up next weekend on this station or online anytime at MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com. I'm Tom Lyons, and I hope that you make a difference in someone's life this week.
Minnesota Military Radio is a production of iHeartMedia, the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, the Minneapolis VA, Beyond the Yellow Ribbon, and the Minnesota National Guard. Your host is Tom Lyons, founder and owner of Phelan Partners Limited, a merger and acquisition advisory firm. Tom is a life member of the American Legion, VFW, Vietnam Veterans of America, and the DAV. For podcasts and the latest updates, follow us at MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com.
Please remember to visit MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com for bonus coverage of Ken MacArthur and his story of D-Day and Normandy in World War II.